make them myself. I take one. It's an interesting consistency, midway between a hard candy and a quick-dissolving mint. Strong, but well-flavored. Isla pops too, and then knocks. She chose her gift wisely. The moment Mrs. Trowbridge sees the store stamp, she can't invite us in fast enough. I explain that I feel terrible about the disturbance the other day, and the broken table, and wanted to bring her a little something. I don't think she needs the excuse. Hell, I'm not even sure she hears it before she's bustling us in. Within 2 minutes, I'm searching Evans's room, while Isla keeps the landlady occupied. Isla had noticed Mrs. Trowbridge was growing dill, rosemary, and feverfew, which are apparently all treatments for arthritis, and that gave Isla a conversational in. She explained that her young friend, me, was hoping to see the poor dead lad's room and pay respects. And between getting a gift and finding someone to talk herbalism with, the landlady was too happy to question the odd request. She assured me the boys were in class and I would not be disturbed. Evans had a room of his own, though it's even smaller than mine. Within 20 minutes, I've completed a thorough search. There are textbooks, all shoved in a dusty corner, suggesting he was a recent graduate. One pornographic novel, tucked away where the landlady won't find it. One hash pipe, well used and also recently used. The residue inside suggests opium. That pipe nudges a thought, but I push it aside for now. I rummage through his clothing and toiletries, but find nothing hidden there. In a place of prominence lies a scrapbook of his newspaper articles. I thumb through it and then slip it into the bag I brought for our alleged shopping trip. Yes, I feel a twinge of discomfort taking a memento his family would want, but I don't have time to read it here, and I doubt I can hunt through old newspapers at the library, if there is a public library. Also, it's been a week since Evans's death, and it doesn't look as if any family has either come to collect his things or asked for them to be packed away. It's only at the end of my search that I find something truly relevant. I'm checking Evans's jackets when I catch the rustle of paper. I try all the pockets. Empty, save for the lint-shrouded remains of a humbug and one lonely penny. I pat the jacket again. Definitely a rustle. I spread it out on the bed and check the seams until I find a small tear. I rip it open a little more and wriggle my fingers inside to find a folded piece of paper. I open the paper. It's a jotted list of 5 addresses. The top 2 have been crossed off. Beside the next one is a date, several days ago, with a question mark. I'm folding the note when I see writing on the back, too. I smooth it out. It's written in an entirely different penmanship, and when I see what's there, I blink and have to reread. Katrina Mitchell, born 1850, Edinburgh. Family name probably false. Ignore any criminal record under Mitchell dating back to 1865. I have that. I want something I can use to repay the wench for her backstabbing. I'm rereading the note, processing it, when boots clomp on the stairs. I shove the paper into my bodice, then I grab a notebook from the bedside, check for handwriting, and shove it into my bag. I'm out the door when one of Evans's roommates crests the stairs. It's the one who'd been studying the other day, the one who'd tried to rein in the others. He blinks at me in the dim lighting. "What the bloody hell are you doing?" He stops and jabs at the stairs. "Go. Out the back. Thomas is in the front room." I nod and squeeze past him. Then I clamber down the stairs and wheel into the kitchen, where Isla is having tea with Mrs. Trowbridge. Isla starts to smile at me and then rises with a clatter. "My dear girl, you look a fright." She strides over to pat my back reassuringly. "That must have been so difficult for you. I know you were terribly fond of young Archie. The note I found has my brain whirling, and combined with nearly getting caught in the room, I probably am a little pale. Isla must think I'm faking grief for Mrs. Trowbridge's sake. I need some air, I say. I turn to the landlady and curtsy. Thank you so much for your kindness, ma'am. I hope I was not a bother.
Not at all, child. I'm so pleased to know that Archie had a friend who grieves for him.
She glares toward the commotion in the front room as the boys tumble in from school.
He ought to have had more. He was a lovely lad.
Isla says her goodbyes and jots something on a piece of paper, promising Mrs. Trowbridge it will be exactly the thing for her arthritis. Then she bustles me out the door, and we are gone. We're around the corner, near the steps in another close. I've given her the note I found, and she's glaring as she reads it. Katrina strikes again, I mutter, making friends wherever she goes. I am not certain whether I am angrier with her for getting into such scrapes, or this young man for his vindictiveness. So Archie knew Katrina. It's not his handwriting. I show her the book with his penmanship. Then I flip over the note. This side, with the addresses, was written by him. This other side was not. It's someone asking him to dig up dirt on Katrina.
He wrote the addresses after receiving this note.
Maybe. But the note was hidden. The information on Katrina hardly seems something his housemates would care about. I think he was hiding the addresses, which would suggest he wrote them first. Also, it was folded with the addresses inside, and there's no sign of it ever being folded the other way. She examines the note.
You are correct. That is terribly clever.
Nah, just basic detective work. It suggests that he jotted down these addresses and then spoke to someone about them. That person wrote the information about Katrina on the opposite side, which meant Evans had to keep the note. She nods as we walk. And she keeps nodding, as if thinking it through. I'm deep in thought, too. If I mentally shift past the note's connection between Katrina and Evans, there's useful data there on her backstory. I might be able to use that in figuring out who tried to kill her. Then, without looking over, she says casually,
"What are you not telling me, Mallory?"
I don't answer. After a moment, she says,
"Well, I should be glad you are not outright lying and claiming to be hiding nothing. You should be shocked by a connection between the killer and Katrina. Is that not an incredible coincidence? You have already said you are not fond of coincidences, which means you have an explanation for this."
"I'd like to check out this address," I say, tapping the third one with the question mark and a date beside it.
"Truly? Or is that a distraction?"
"Truly. Though it does have the added attraction of allowing me to duck a question I don't want to answer yet. Yes, I am only mildly surprised by a connection between Evans, Katrina, and a third person."
"The third person being the killer?"
I hold out the paper. "Where is this? And don't try withholding your answer from mine, or I'll just walk up to those guys, flash my bosom, and ask very prettily." She snorts.
"Somehow I cannot envision you flashing your bosom or asking prettily."
I lower my lashes.
"Please, sir, if you might be of assistance, I am trying to find the home of my elderly aunt who recently moved, and I believe I have been sent to the entirely wrong area. I am but a poor milkmaid from the country, all alone in the big city and so dreadfully overwhelmed."
I clear my throat. "Okay, the last part might oversell it."
"Depends on whether you want directions or a coach and escort."
"And a lap to sit in?"
She chokes on a laugh.
Yes, I believe the coach would be sadly overcrowded, forcing you to settle into a lap.
She shakes her head and takes the note.
It is about a half-mile walk. Come along.
We're outside a toy shop, and I'm ogling it as if I'm six again, standing outside F.A.O. Schwartz in New York. As a child, I'd have found this tiny shop a disappointment compared to the bright and colorful ones I was used to. But as an adult, it's a straight sugar shot of nostalgia for a world I've only ever seen on Christmas cards and in holiday movies. A place of Victorian magic, with marionettes dancing in the front window and a train set ready to chug around the base.
Kaplan, Isla murmurs, eyeing the sign. Is that not what Evans's companions railed against in their pamphlets?
Toy stores.
Immigration.
I frown over at her.
The owners are Russian Jewish immigrants, she says.
I'm about to ask whether she knows them.
Then it clicks.
The store name.
Yes. If pressed, I could probably identify Kaplan as a Jewish surname, but that means nothing to me.
You certainly can't presume that anyone with a Jewish surname is an immigrant. Or you can't if you're in 21st century Vancouver.
So I ask a different question. How do you know they're Russian?
I misspoke, she says. They could be from surrounding Slavic countries. They also may not be recent immigrants. I have a friend whose grandfather fled Russia after the execution of Gregory V. As she says, he escaped one kind of persecution to discover another. But at least this one seemed 50% less likely to get him killed. The point is that this is an established business operating under an openly foreign name, and thus it may have attracted the attention of Archie Evans's friends.
I frown at the shop.
I'm surprised it's open, this being the Sabbath.
Her brows rise. It is not Sunday, Katrina.
For Jews, the Sabbath is Saturday.
A look passes over her face, almost a sadness.
Ah, I did not know that. My friend never shared much on her faith. It marked her as different, I fear, even with me.
Closing on a Saturday would mark them as different.
She nods toward the shop.
So they do not. And Saturdays can be quite busy. Some of the local factories have begun allowing their workers to leave mid-afternoon to enjoy an extended weekending with their families.
Not in the era of two-day weekends yet, are we?
Hmm?
I shake my head.
Nothing. As for the shop being on Evans's list, we know the group is anti-immigration. We know he was selling information on their activities to someone. If this place was a target, that might be what he was selling.
I pass over the list.
Any of these others close by?
The last one is a block over.
Let's take a look.
Chapter 33. We're outside the next address. Like the toy shop, it's in one of the better areas of the old town. This address is a private residence in a close. Isla buys two fresh loaves of bread at a nearby shop, and we climb the stairs to the right address and rap on the door. It cracks open. After a pause, a woman with a baby on her hip pulls it the rest of the way, still eyeing us with suspicion.
"Aye?" she says.
"We're looking for a Mrs. Ryan," Isla says. "We were given this address."
"There's no Mrs. Ryan here," the woman says in a thick Irish accent and begins to withdraw.
"Wait," Isla says. She smiles at the baby. "Since we do not have Mrs. Ryan's proper address, we cannot deliver these loaves. Perhaps you would take them?" The woman studies Isla, her gaze narrowing. Then she smooths out her expression and shakes her head and murmurs, "No, thank you, ma'am. You should find your Mrs. Ryan." The door closes and we climb down the stairs to stand in the courtyard. "Not immigrants, then," I say. "And is it me or was she acting oddly?" Isla stares at me a moment. Then she laughs. "They were most certainly immigrants. Did you not hear her accent?" "They're Irish. That's not the same thing, right?"
"It is most certainly the same thing."
She tucks the loaves into my shopping bag. "We may have some immigration from Eastern Europe and other parts of the world, but the great hunger sent the Irish here in droves, and many Scots were not happy to see them."
"The great hunger?
Oh, is that the potato famines?"
She nods.
"It has been 20 years, yet there is extreme prejudice still in some areas. That is why she was wary, and it is why she did not trust the bread. It is also why the family's residence would be on that list. Show it to me again." I do, and she says the first two addresses are in an area we shouldn't visit alone, but the remaining one is on our walk back to the new town. When we reach the area, I look around at the towering, teeming slums.
You said the others were in neighborhoods we shouldn't visit alone. Worse than this?"
"Yes. Worse than this." I look around us, trying to imagine it. Isla continues. "There are neighborhoods with buildings 10 stories tall, with no running water or sewage. One collapsed on High Street while Duncan was in school. 77 residents, 35 dead. A lecturer took his medical students to see it. Not to assist with the wounded, purely as an intellectual exercise. Bodies were still in the rubble and Duncan..." She inhales sharply. "It affected him greatly." She glances at me. "I know my brother can seem distant and single-minded, but he still sends money each year to the families of those killed. Anonymously, of course. Even I am not supposed to know."
"Is nothing being done then?" I say, waving around. "About this?"
"Yes, something is being done. They are clearing the slums. You will see notices here and there. The buildings being knocked down, the people sent on their way. No reparations, no assistance. Driven out as if they were rats. For their own good. To convince them to better themselves, because all they need, obviously, is motivation." Bitter sarcasm drips from her voice. "Nothing has changed there either, then. The poor just need a kick in the ass to punt them into the middle class."
"The need is overwhelming," she says, looking about. "In the truest sense of the word. I see this, and I am like Duncan at the sight of that collapse. Overwhelmed. I want to run to every door with one of these loaves of bread, ensure everyone has food in their belly tonight. But then what? Perhaps rather than a single loaf of bread for all, I could sponsor families and see to their needs. Yet most do not want that. Others are beyond that sort of help, lost in a bottle of spirits or laudanum, whichever dulls the pain of this." She waves at the tenements. My gaze catches on a girl, no more than 5, dressed in a sack of a dress, her arms piled high with clean laundry. Then on a man, half drunk in a doorway, staring listlessly, seeing nothing.
"Is it better in your world?" she says. "Please tell me it is not like this still."
"Parts are better," I say, "but not as much as they should be. Where I live, Vancouver, we have a lot of homelessness. People living on the streets. Even after years of patrol, I couldn't help wanting to help.
With some, I could, but it never felt like enough. Most didn't want the name of a shelter or a clinic. Addicted to drugs and alcohol, as you say. Or suffering from mental illness. A lot of mental illness. And then, for some, it's a choice, however hard that is to imagine. Eventually, I had to acknowledge that as much as I want to help them all, they're people, not stray cats.
Not stray cats, she repeats, and her eyes glisten.
Yes, that is exactly the lesson I have had to learn, and it is a hard one.
She pops a mint from her tin. Take Alice. When Hugh brought her to me, my impulse was to adopt her. Hire a child to labor in my home? Absolutely not. Hugh counseled against an adoption, and that may be the worst fight we have ever had. Duncan stayed out of it, but he asked me to employ Alice for a month before making any decisions, and I saw my mistake soon enough. To me, being a child like that, adopted into a well-to-do family, would be a dream come true, the stuff of novels. Yet Alice would have run away had I suggested it. She wants to earn her keep, and anything else smacks of charity and obligation. I am educating her, which she enjoys very much, and I have hopes of easing her into a life where her dreams rise above her station. But it is a slow process.
And she is not a stray cat.
A wry smile my way. She is not. We climb rickety steps to an apartment, half the size of my small Vancouver condo. The apartment is home to two Irish families and their children. One of the women is cleaning, as the other tends to the smallest of the children, and the older ones help their fathers, doing tailoring work by the window. The apartment is... I hesitate to use the word squalid. That suggests they're living in their own filth, which they absolutely are not. They've made the best of what they have, but no amount of scrubbing will scour away the wood and coal soot stained into every surface, and no amount of polishing the lone window will lift the gloom. I keep thinking of that jail cell, and how I'd spent the night in the corner, huddled in horror, waiting to escape. These people can't escape. I've seen rough living in Vancouver, and I'd known that behind the tenement doors in the old town, I'd find conditions to make our worst look like luxury living. Yet I'm still not prepared for this. And to my shame, I can't wait to get out onto the street again.
I'm glad they took the bread, Isla murmurs after we leave. I noticed one of the babies has croup.
She continues to talk about what remedies she might send, and whether they'd accept a basket of other goods as well. I'm still in too much shock to process her words. Too much shock to also process what I see next. We're walking down the street, and at a shout behind me, I turn. It's just a man yelling at a kid running past, jostling a woman. But as I turn, someone steps out from a side road and then retreats fast, backpedaling. That alone wouldn't have caught my eye. The street is congested with people scurrying about. I'm not sure why I noticed this one. And that is a testament to my preoccupation, because when recognition hits, I can't believe it took even a split second. Wait here, I say to Isla as I stride back to the corner. I peer down it, looking for a retreating figure with dark hair of average size. While the street is busy, I should still be able to see him. But I don't. I stride back to Isla as she heads my way.
Did you call Simon to...
I stop mid-sentence with a shake of my head. This isn't the 21st century, where she can text Simon to come fetch us. Is there any reason Simon would be here? I ask.
Simon?
Did you ask him to pick us up in the area? I say.
Certainly not. If we wish a ride home, we will flag down a hansom cab. Are you saying you saw our Simon?
We returned to the intersection. There's still no sign of him.
Perhaps it was someone who looked like him, she says. He's a well-favored young man, but not unusual in his appearance.
It was Simon. When he saw me looking, he retreated fast.
Her brows furrow. That is most odd.
Does he have any connection to this area? A reason he'd be here?
No. And there is a funeral this afternoon. He should be at the stables polishing the carriages.
I motion for us to walk. Isla doesn't push me to talk, just lets me fall into thoughtful silence as she directs us back to the new town. Earlier, Evans's hash pipe had caught my attention. Just last night, Simon had offered me opium. I'd made the connection, but hadn't pursued it, no more than if I'd found they both liked to play golf. Yet a shared hobby means the possibility of intersecting lives. Two young men, around the same age, who both use opium. Not exactly a rock-solid link. But then there's Katrina. Whoever wrote the note in my bag knew tidbits of her past, the sort you might share with friends. Katrina and Simon are friends. Probably also romantically involved, however casually. And the person most likely to murder a woman is her partner. Yet I struggle to imagine that from the young man I had tea with last night. Except if the killer jumped into Simon's body, then that wasn't Simon. I would have never met the real Simon. If the killer knew Katrina and Simon had been friends, occasionally with benefits, he could play that role. And he would know it if that was one of the tidbits he'd gotten from Archie Evans. Simon claimed he didn't know where Katrina sold her stolen goods, didn't know anything about her past or her confederates. His excuse, that he kept out of that part of her life, made sense. But it could also be the modern killer covering for his gaps in Simon knowledge. Katrina had a knack for betraying her friends, selling them out, as she had with Constable Findlay and, from what Davina said, many others. Isla hires staff that have been in trouble with the law. Does that include Simon? I got that impression, and while I also got the impression he was trying to steer Katrina away from that life, I must remember that if Simon is the killer, then the Simon I know is not the one Katrina knew, and I can rely on nothing he said. Could the killer become Simon? He'd need to know Edinburgh well enough to play coachman, but he's presumably from here in the modern world and could figure it out. If he had any experience with horses, he could pull off caring for them and cleaning the stables as much as I could pull off being a maid. He lives over the stables and rarely comes in the house. Or this Simon rarely comes in. Possibly because he's minimizing interaction with people who know the real Simon. If Simon is the killer, he'd definitely know I'd been helping with the case. He could easily have targeted me. Hell, he watched me leave the night I was attacked. I'd come out the back door and bumped into him dressed in dark colors. I'd bumped into him last night, too, when he'd hidden in the library and jumped out at me. Jumped out to spook me? So he claimed, but what if I hadn't fought him off? Had there been a length of rope in his pocket? Had he come into the house to kill me in my sleep? He does have a key. What if Simon knew Evans, possibly through a mutual habit? Could Evans have been selling his information to Simon? Probably not. That's the proverbial red herring. Evans was selling information to someone for some purpose, and while hanging out with Simon, Simon had jotted down information on Katrina, using the paper Evans was carrying. Katrina had betrayed Simon, and he wanted dirt on her. As her friend, he knew that dirt exists. Evans was a journalist. He could investigate Katrina. Except the situation intensified.
Simon followed Katrina and saw her doing something, further betraying him. In a rage, Simon strangled her. Then the killer from my world took over Simon's body and made contact with Evans. The killer saw an information treasure trove, tortured Evans for everything he knew about Simon, and then killed him for his first victim. Chapter 34. I think this through as we walk. Isla obviously has experience with people being lost in thought, both her brother and herself, I expect, and she recognizes the signs and leaves me to it. "May I ask about Simon?" I say, as we cut through Parliament Square. "Since you've been back from holidays, has he seemed any different to you?" "Different? Is he acting oddly? I've spoken to him a few times. He seems to be friends with Katrina." "He is?" "More than friends, I think." Which is awkward. Her brows crease.
"More than friends? How?"
"Romantically involved, maybe? Or just fooling around together now and then. Friends with benefits, Victorian style." I expect her to laugh at the term, but she frowns at me.
"Simon?"
"Yes. That isn't the impression you got?" "They must have hidden it. I guess they would. Premarital sex is verboten here, right?"
"Supposedly, but liaisons between grooms and maids are common. They would hardly flaunt it, but I very sincerely doubt there was any entanglement. Not with Simon."
I thought she'd been going to say Katrina had other romantic interests, which I know she did. When she says Simon instead, that pulls me up short. "Is he gay?" I ask. Her brow furrows more.
"He is quite a cheerful lad."
"Wrong word. Queer?"
"Odd. No, not really."
Third time's the charm. "Homosexual?" That has her flushing in a way premarital sex didn't. She casts a quick glance around and lowers her voice as she steers me away from others.
"I presume that is more acceptable in your world, and I am glad to hear it."
I consider. "Has Oscar Wilde gone to trial yet?"
"Oscar who?"
That answers my question. He's one of the most famous writers of the Victorian era, and another of my faves. When he starts writing, you should read his books and check out his plays. He'll be tried and convicted of indecency, though. For homosexuality. She sighs.
"And that is still in our future. Lovely. As for Simon..."
She glances over.
"Is this important?"
"Anything you can tell me about him is important." She says nothing, and we've gone clear across to High Street before she speaks again.
"I am refraining from the obvious reaction, which is to exclaim that you cannot possibly suspect Simon of these murders based on something as mildly concerning as thinking you saw him following us."
"I did see him following us."
"Still, I presume there's more, and it's connected to the things you are avoiding telling me. I hope you are not doing so out of any consideration for my sensibilities. I get quite enough of that from Hugh. A few childhood incidents, and I am forever branded faint of heart."
She walks a few more steps before continuing.
"Perhaps the last was well past childhood, but it was entirely Duncan's fault. One does not expect to step into one's place of family business and see one's brother playing with a decapitated head."
"Playing?" She huffs.
"Examining it. But he seemed to be talking to it, and I did not realize Hugh was also in the room, and so it gave me a start."
I sputter a laugh. "Alas, poor Yorick."
"Yes. Only this skull still had a face, which made it so much worse. I fainted, which was primarily due to the heat and the tightness of my corset as I was off to a garden party. The concussion was quite mild, and the nightmare stopped after a few weeks. But you would think I was scarred for life to hear Hugh tell the tale."
"Hey, if you're okay with nightmares and fainting spells, I won't stand in your way. No, I'm not holding back out of concern for your sensibilities. Your brother and Detective MacReady are the reason I'd rather not explain my theory.
In order to tell it to them, we'd need to explain the time traveling. So, to tell you would put you into an awkward position.
The same awkward position that you are already in.
Yes, but it's not my brother or my friend.
I would like to take that responsibility, Mallory.
I open my mouth to protest. Then I shut it. Isla lives in a world of endless, insurmountable walls and locked gates. Thy name is woman, and so thou shalt not pass. By protecting her, I'm doing the same thing she's doing to Gray, but it feels different to her. And I need to put myself in her place and understand that. If she chooses to take this risk, do I have the right to refuse her? Especially if not telling her could damage the investigation, rob me of a person to bounce my ideas off. I told myself that when this secret endangered the investigation, I'd share it. We've reached that point. All right, I say finally, as we approach the gardens leading to the new town. May I ask that we finish discussing Simon first? Trust that I have a good reason for suspecting him. Answer my questions, and then I'll tell you. When she hesitates, I say, You have my word on that, Isla. It's not a trick. I would rather ask these questions without you being influenced by my theory.
All right. I trust you, and I will prove that by sharing information I would never give to anyone in our household, including my brother. When it comes to the pasts of my employees, I share them with Duncan only as they affect him.
Need-to-know basis.
Quite. He must know that Katrina is a thief, or Alice a pickpocket. He does not need to know that Simon was a...
She clears her throat.
He found himself in trouble because he consorted with men. Older homosexual men.
He was a sex worker? I guess.
Actually, no. That is, I do not think so, in the strictest sense. And if he did accept money, it is no different from a shop girl accepting rent from a wealthy admirer. Simon...
She coughs into her gloved hand.
I apologize if I stumble here, which must seem terribly quaint to you. I consider myself a woman of the world, and yet... I know the world extends beyond my experience with it. Simon had a friend, a young man who was not quite as handsome, but was very charming and garrulous. I believe they were merely friends, but it is none of my business either way. The two of them played a sport of dressing as girls, a very pretty and charming pair of girls who frequented theaters and such establishments and... flirted with men who knew exactly what they were and enjoyed participating in the performance. Liaisons were formed to the financial benefit of Simon and his friend. It is not a world I inhabit, but I see no harm in it.
All parties were consenting.
Yes.
She turns onto Princess Street and lowers her voice more.
The problem came when Simon's friend extricated himself from an attachment that had proven increasingly worrisome. He found a new benefactor, and his old one killed both him and his new lover.
I should express shock, and I make a noise that approximates it, but I've seen this before. Simon's friend fled a toxic relationship, and he was murdered for it. Too common a tale, whatever the time period. Isla continues.
It threatened to be quite a scandal, especially given that the murderer was a man of high standing in the city. The police were bribed to look the other way. I fear they were only too happy to wash their hands of the matter. They did, however, need a scapegoat, and their eye fell on Simon.
Shit.
He was 18, the son of an Irish immigrant, and involved in what they considered deviant behavior. He avoided the gallows only because one of his past lovers had the influence to help him and did not, thankfully, fear getting involved. This man knows Hugh, and through him knew my hiring practices, and so I took on Simon as a groom. I would not presume to say I know him well.
but I am quite certain he chose that former life of his own volition, following his own propensities. Meaning he likes other men, not pretty housemaids. Yes, he was, as you say, friends with Katrina. I saw no hint of anything more. I ask more questions. Did Katrina and Simon have a recent falling out? Argue? Not that Isla knows of, but she'd been gone for a month, and Gray rarely notices domestic drama. Does Simon seem any different? Isla describes him as quiet, which is not the guy I've been talking to. To her, he seems like himself, but they've had little contact. He interacts more with Gray, who is not the most observant guy when it comes to his employees. At that point, I need to tell Isla everything, which means we circle the block around the townhouse twice. The first time, I'm explaining that I think the killer is the guy who attacked me in the 21st century, who was thrown into the body of Katrina's attacker. And I think that attacker, and body, is Simon. The second circle is spent in silence as she works that through. Makes sense, she says slowly, as we steer to add an extra block onto our walk. The inciting event is the attack happening in two periods. Two women attacked by two men in a similar manner on the same spot. If you jumped into Katrina, it is logical that your attacker could have jumped into hers. I don't answer. She's working it through, and we're to the next corner before she says, "Do you know anything of the man who attacked you in your time?" I saw his face, but that doesn't help. He was a serial killer who'd murdered two people, strangled them with a rope like he'd used on me. I'd seen him earlier that day in a coffee shop. I spilled coffee on him. Her brows shoot up. It was my fault. I was distracted, trying to do too many things at once, and I bumped into him. I apologized. I felt terrible. But he brushed me off and then stalked me and tried to murder me. That seems excessive. In my world, people have been drawn and quartered for less. I glance over at her. Kidding, obviously. It wasn't an overreaction to the coffee spill as much as an excuse. Some serial killers murder indiscriminately because it's about the act, not the victim. For others, it's about the victims, picking people who remind them of mommy or the girl who turned them down or whatever. With this guy, it was a game. He let his victims self-select, so to speak. If someone pisses him off, in a very ordinary way, can he track and kill them? Cerebral, she murmurs. That's what you and Duncan called the murder of Archie Evans. Methodical and cerebral, lacking passion or bloodlust. If I were to speculate, based on the murders in my time and here, I'd say that we're dealing with a guy who thinks he's clever. His driving force is ego. He wants to get away with it, and because he's not compelled to kill in a specific way, he can avoid patterns and connections that would get him caught. Then he arrives here before the golden age of serial killers. The golden... She shakes her head. I don't even want to know what that means. Presumably they become more common? To many people in our time, the first serial killer doesn't strike for another 20 years. He wasn't the first, but he's still the most famous. This guy comes here and thinks he can steal his thunder, be clever and memorable. Except no one cares. So he goes another route. Replicate those murders. Out-Ripper the Ripper. Another headshake. I definitely don't want to ask about that. You do not. The point is that he replicated a future famous murder and will undoubtedly continue on with the rest of the killing spree, meaning we need to stop him before he does. Agreed. We recognized each other in that attack, I say. I believe he knows who I am, and I know who he was. It's the was part that's a problem. He has the advantage. And you think he's now Simon? I'm theorizing that he could be Simon. What I need from you is either proof that the guy in Simon's body is Simon, or additional support for the idea that it might not be.
I honestly can't say either way, Mallory. I haven't had enough contact with him in these last few days.
Then the next step for me is finding proof. I'm not going to approach him directly. That's dangerous if he's the killer, because the killer realizes I'm not Katrina either. Would Mrs. Wallace know Simon better than you?
Yes, but she is not fond of Katrina.
Oh, I know it. I can work around that. I'll talk to her, and maybe talk to Dr. Gray if I can. And then, when I have a better idea either way, I'm going to ask you to send Simon on an errand so I can search his room. Can you do that?
Easily.
Good.
Chapter 35. I've been in the house for an hour and haven't spoken to Mrs. Wallace yet. First, I told myself I needed to come up with subtle questions. Then, I decided I should do some housework so she won't grumble about me shirking my duties. The truth is that I want time to think, because I don't like this solution to the puzzle. It fits. I know my 21st century killer inhabits the body of Katrina's 19th century one. I know he tortured Archie Evans for something, and I could be wrong about what, but I am not wrong that Evans was investigating Katrina on behalf of someone who might have been angry enough to kill her. Is it possible that the note in Evans's pocket isn't from the killer? Katrina certainly had multiple enemies. But that would mean the killer randomly grabbed and tortured the friend of someone else Katrina had wronged. Yeah, that'd be one hell of a coincidence, and like Isla, I don't like them. Simon fits. He's friends with Katrina. She's still up to her criminal ways. She gets him involved in something and it goes sideways, or Katrina yanks it sideways, and he tries to kill her. The problem with that scenario? Simon wasn't a thief, wasn't a pickpocket, wasn't any sort of criminal. He was a gay kid who dressed up as a girl to flirt with men and find himself a sugar daddy. That fits with what I know of Simon, better than I first thought. I'd interpreted flirting, but I can't say it was more than me jumping to stereotypical conclusions about a close relationship between a handsome young man and a pretty young woman. Simon had no problem with her relationship with Constable Finley. He even gave her shit for playing Finley wrong. He also gave her shit for not giving up her thieving ways. As for me seeing a different side of him than Isla did, does that mean he's a different guy? Or just different with a friend versus an employer? The opium link still bothers me. Seeing him today in the tenements definitely bothers me. I know I saw him. I know he retreated when he spotted me. I'm almost done dusting the library when a possible explanation thuds into my brain. Dusting rag in hand, I march downstairs to the funeral parlor. I walk in to find Gray deep in paperwork. He looks up as I close the door behind me. "Didn't you have a funeral this afternoon?" I say. He blinks, and I realize I've been hanging out with Isla too long today. I need to code switch before I talk to anyone else in this world. I half curtsy.
"Apologies, sir. I came to clean expecting to find the offices empty, as Mrs. Ballantyne said there was a funeral today."
"Tomorrow. She has confused her days."
"Then, if I may be so bold, sir, may I ask whether you gave Simon a half day off? Or perhaps dispatched him on an errand into the old town?"
He hesitates.
"I saw Simon in the old town, sir, and he seemed to be following Mrs. Ballantyne, which is concerning, unless you sent him to do so."
He slowly sets down his pen, exhales through his teeth, and then runs a hand through his hair, streaking ink up his forehead.
"May I be blunt, Katrina?"
I plunk into the chair in front of him, as much as one can plunk, wearing multiple layers of skirts. He speaks slowly, as if picking through his word choices.
"I understand my sister has forgiven you for her locket, and I know you were attacked by this killer we seek. I do not wish to seem mistrusting."
But Mrs. Ballantyne is your sister, and I have not yet proven myself, and so you were concerned for her safety. You overheard us going out, and you asked Simon to follow us to be certain she was in no danger from me.
Yes.
He straightens.
I am sorry if you are offended.
Not offended. I pause. Also, apologizing for cutting you off, sir. You have reason for your mistrust. I spotted Simon and was concerned when he seemed to be following Mrs. Ballantyne.
You were concerned about Simon?
I shrug. I am a suspicious person, and it was suspicious behavior. I am glad that we cleared that up. I rise. Will I see you at tea?
Yes, and thank you for understanding my caution, Katrina.
I'm barely in the hall when the back door flies open and Isla zips in, shutting it behind her. She doesn't see me until she turns to find me standing there with my arms crossed. The one thing about gaslighting, it doesn't exactly illuminate things well, things such as the glower on my face, and she hurries over and whispers, "It is not Simon. I mean, the person who appears to be Simon is actually Simon."
"You searched his room?"
My voice rises. "Of course not. I am hardly a detective. I spoke to him."
"You..."
Gray leans out the parlor door.
"Is everything all right?"
I turn and half curtsy. "Apologies, sir. I was telling Mrs. Ballantyne that she was mistaken about the funeral today, and that you invited her to tea with Detective MacReady. We will retreat upstairs so as not to disturb your work." He heads back into the funeral parlor, and I glare at Isla, making sure I'm under the lights so she can see my expression. Then I herd her up 3 flights of stairs to the attic. Only when her laboratory door closes behind me do I let myself explode.
"You questioned Simon? By yourself?"
"You said you could not, and I agreed. So I did it myself." She settles onto a chair. "I was very discreet."
"He could have been a killer."
"He is not."
"You didn't know..."
I bite my tongue. This is going to take us right back where we were earlier, with Isla accusing me of patronizing her. We're going to need to talk about this. A long discussion on the danger of what she just did, and the fact that she isn't an amateur sleuth in a Victorian novel. I need to say that without sounding as if I'm treating her like a child, and I'm not in the mental state to navigate that conversation successfully. I'll return to it when I'm calmer. I take a moment to find my equilibrium and say, "I wish you'd spoken to me, but we can discuss that later." "So, you talked to him?" "I was quite clever about it, if I do say so myself." I bite back the urge to say that clever is not the word I'd use for approaching a potential killer without backup. But her face glows with the exhilaration of success, and I can't bring myself to douse it with a blast of reality. Later, I will. For now, I put myself in her place. Her very delineated role, all those walls and barricades that even a progressive family cannot knock down for her. I have punched a hole through one of those walls, giving her a peek into possibilities beyond, a glimpse of excitement and adventure. Can I blame her for missing the quicksand and the crocodiles and seeing only a glimmering tropical paradise? She'll need to see those crocodiles and that quicksand. The sooner the better. But I can't treat her like a child. She's a brilliant and capable woman. "What did you do?" I ask, knowing she's waiting for this. "I went to the stables and found him within, currying the horses. I asked him to step out. That seemed safer than speaking to him inside." A sidelong look my way, and I grudgingly acknowledge the precaution with a nod. She continues. "I pointed out a loose cobblestone as my excuse, so it would not seem suspicious that I summoned him out of doors. Then I commended him for the excellent work he'd done, repairing the path into my garden. How it was quite smooth now, and I no longer caught my heel on the stones."
"Uh-huh."
He was quite confused, as he did not repair the path at all. He reminded me that it is the gardener's work, and while he will be quite happy to tell Mr. Tull about the loose cobblestone, he did not have the means to do more than temporarily fix it himself.
Ah.
I said yes, I only meant for him to tell Mr. Tull about the stone. As for the garden path, I said I was under the impression he'd aided Mr. Tull with that. He said no, he had not. We'd had two funerals that day, but he was glad the job was to my satisfaction.
Which proves he really is Simon.
Quite. An impostor would have agreed to fix the cobblestone, and he'd have taken credit for helping with the garden. Therefore, it is Simon, though I am still concerned that you saw him following us.
That was your brother's doing. The more I considered Simon as a suspect, the less I liked it. I could explain away everything except seeing him today, and so I followed a hunch on that.
A hunch that Duncan had us followed.
Her mouth tightens.
That is not like him. He can be protective, but he knows I venture into the old town on my own.
He wasn't protecting you from unsavory neighborhoods. As long as he thinks I'm Katrina, who stole a locket I knew was very important to you, he's not going to trust me.
A matter which we shall resolve as soon as his paper is delivered.
She rises.
All right, then. Have we resolved all questions about Simon? Did anything else connect him to Archie Evans, beyond his association?
A hash pipe?
It's used for smoking opium, and I found residue in it.
Her lips twitch.
I know what a hashish pipe is, Mallory. I am not that sheltered. My confusion arises from the nature of the connection. Did Evans have one belonging to Simon?
No, but they both use opium.
And?
I shrug. I'm not saying they're the only two young men in Edinburgh who do, but it could have brought them into contact. Maybe in an opium den?
Opium den?
She says slowly. Wrong time period?
No, it's the correct one, but you do realize opium is not illegal.
What?
She walks over and squeezes my shoulder. Poor Mallory, from a time so backwards that it has outlawed sweet opium.
She catches my expression and laughs.
I am teasing you.
While opium has its uses, it is highly addictive, whether for personal use or for treating pain. But it's legal?
As is alcohol, which I might argue has ruined more lives. No, if Simon indulges, it is minor and irregular use. I've seen no indication of impairment. Consider it no different from a young man having a pint or two at the public house, and he would be equally likely to encounter Evans there. Simon is cleared, which sends me back to square one. Who strangled Katrina in that alley? Who, from her long list of enemies, finally snapped? That sends me in circles because I only know that she has enemies. Damn the girl for not keeping a journal.
Dear Diary, today the butcher's son threatened to throttle me for stealing from his weekly deliveries. Tee-hee, what fun!
I really need to talk to Davina. I hate the idea of dealing with her bullshit, and I hate giving her what I know is a small fortune for her information. But I need to stop making excuses, grit my teeth, and get it over with. I'll do that tonight. I'll slip out, making sure I'm well-armed and extremely cautious, with plans to be home before the pubs close. Flip that note from Evans's room, then. For the moment, forget the threat against Katrina and return to the list of addresses. If the killer was Simon, I could see no obvious connection to the addresses of immigrants, so I'd brushed off the note as circumstantial. Simon just happened to write on the back of those addresses, which Evans had been sharing with a third party. But if the killer is not Simon, is it still coincidental? Evans was sharing or selling information about his housemates. Why addresses? Were they targets? That makes sense. His asshole roommates are compiling addresses to target the residents with hate crimes or other persecution. The first two had been crossed off. Removed from the list of possibilities? Or already dealt with? There had been a date beside the toy shop. Was that when they intended to act? Who would Evans share that with? And why? Another group wanting to beat them to the punch? A rival proto-Nazi frat? Like a sick pledge challenge. See who can torch the most immigrant homes and businesses? Unlikely. It's not as if there are only 5 immigrant homes and businesses in the city. This might not be Vancouver, but if you include the Irish fleeing the potato famines, I'm going to put immigrants at 5% of the population. That means 1 in every 20 households fits their definition of outsiders. You can damn well find some yourself without buying a list from some reporter. So what value is the list? I remember the date beside the toy shop. We're past that date, and there was no sign of damage to the shop. That gives me an idea. And if I'm right, another clue floating in the ether, seemingly meaningless, will clunk into place. I need to confirm my suspicion. Can I get to the toy shop and back before tea? I check the clock. I'm cutting it close, very close. But the store will be closed afterward, and every wasted day is another chance for the killer to take his next Jack the Ripper-style victim. I hurry into the library and pen a quick note for Isla. I don't try to find her. She'd want to join me, and then I really would be late for tea. I grab a few coins from Katrina's stash, and I'm off. Chapter 36. The toy shop truly is a wonderland of a place. From the outside, it looks like a high-end store in the modern world, where the toys are really meant for adults to display as whimsical accents or to place high on nursery shelves where grubby hands can't actually reach them. When I step inside, though, I find actual children milling about under the watchful but kindly eye of a shop clerk. The clerk is a woman around 30, dark-haired and dark-eyed and full-figured. She's smiling at a trio of girls ogling a fully articulated wooden doll. "You may touch her if you like," she says. "Go on, pick her up. See how her arms and legs move." I walk to the counter and she smiles my way, but it's an absent smile, her attention on the children, enjoying the sight of their wonder. I pause to enjoy it too, and I feel the weight of the coins in my pocket. I take out the coins, push them forward, and whisper, "Would this be enough?" as I nod toward the girls. The woman glances at the coins and her face lights, only to shudder as she eyes me warily. "I truly would like to," I say, "if it is enough." She nods and moves from behind the counter, skirts swishing as she bends beside the girls and whispers to them. They look at me, their eyes widening. She directs their attention to 3 smaller dolls, not quite as fancy. The girls nod and point. They will take 1 small doll apiece instead of the 1 large one to share. The shopkeeper wraps each doll in blank newsprint as carefully as the Newtown shopkeeper wrapped that hand cream in tissue. Then she presents 1 to each girl. She bends before them and says, "You are to tell your parents that there was a kind woman at the toy shop who bought these for you, and if they have any questions, they may speak to me." The girls haven't looked at me since first glancing my way, and now all 3 murmur awkward thanks before running to the door, doll packages cradled in their arms. Before they leave, 1 blurts back at me, "You are very pretty, miss." And another says, "I like your dress," while the 3rd only giggles and waves. Then they are gone, scampering off down the street. "That was very kind," the shopkeeper says, as she returns behind the counter to count out my change. When she hands me back coins, I pause. "Was that enough?" She smiles. "It was. We do not make fancy toys here. simple and sturdy toys for those who might spare a pence or two for their bairns, which is not many, even in this neighbourhood. Her dialect and accent are pure Scots, and so I speak carefully when I say, "Are you one of the Caplan family?" She tenses, and a sliver of annoyance edges into her voice as she says, "Do I not sound as you expected?" "No, I am only making sure, because I have a message for the Caplan family, and I did not wish to misdeliver it." Now her body goes rigid, gaze darting to a door which I presume leads to a workshop. Through it comes the muffled tap-tapping of a craftsman at work. "Not that sort of message," I say quickly. "I found this shop on a list of addresses that I fear may indicate danger. Addresses of immigrants written by those who may mean them harm." She relaxes. "Ah, all right then. Well, I thank you very much for the warning, but the police have already been informed and thwarted whatever those ruffians had in mind." "Oh?" She leans against the counter. "A criminal officer came by last week to warn us that there might be trouble on a certain day. He had the patrols coming past all evening, and my husband and my father slept in the shop here. It would not be the first time we have had trouble. We have been here since before I was born, and still some do not welcome us." "I am sorry to hear that." "We are welcome in this neighborhood because people know us, and they bought toys from us when they were wee bairns themselves. Yet trouble still finds its way from the outside. We have learned to guard ourselves, but this time the police did their jobs. They found young men loitering about intent on trouble, and they gave them a fright."
"Good."
She smiles. "Very good. We were most pleased." I double-check, confirming that the date the police were concerned about is the one on Evans's note. "It is." "I do appreciate that you brought us this information." She waves around the shop. "Please, take something with our thanks, anything you like." I shake my head. "Thank you, but I am only glad the danger was averted." "Are there no bairns in your life who would like a toy?" she coaxes. "No," I say. "No children." I'm idly looking around the shop when my gaze falls on a wooden box. "Ah," she smiles. "For yourself, perhaps?" She takes the box from the shelf. It's simply constructed, but the polished wood shines. When I open the lid, the box plays a tune I don't recognize. On the inside of the lid, there's a tin plate showing a girl with a parasol walking over a footbridge.
"Not for me," I say, "but there's a parlor maid in the house where I work."
"You are in service, then?"
"What a kind thing to do for a wee working girl."
She starts wrapping the box before I can protest. I still try, but she says, "I insist. It is worth less than the dolls." I'm not so sure about that, but I let her wrap it and hand it to me.
"May I ask one more thing?" I say. "If I were to come into information like this again, I would like to take it to the proper authorities. I hesitated to go to the police because, as you say, they do not always trouble themselves with such concerns. It seems this particular criminal officer is different. Might I have his name?"
She beams. "Certainly. It is Detective MacCready." Detective MacCready, who'd been coming to Gray's townhouse that night I was attacked, and then turned away as if he'd forgotten something. Or as if he'd spotted me, followed me into the old town, and attacked me. While there are a few questions I'll want answered by our criminal officer friend, I don't spend more than 2 seconds seriously considering him for the role of killer. No matter how much I know about Katrina, I struggle to fully inhabit her. The only reason anyone buys my act is that blow-to-the-head excuse. The imposter killer might have tortured Evans for background on his new body's life, but there's a limit to how well he'll be able to fool friends. Gray and Isla have known Hugh MacCready since they were children together. They've been close friends for most of their lives. I cannot imagine the imposter would be able to pull that off. There's another link, though. The one that sent me to the toy store. The clue I'd seen, floating over the investigation, apparently meaningless until, with a jolt, it had taken on meaning. What had MacReady said about Evans that first night, when Gray was working over his body? That Evans worked the crime beat. The only thing it meant at the time was that it explained how MacReady knew him. But when I'd considered who Evans might be sharing those addresses,